Church Board. I have several announcements to make, and I also want to point out that there's perhaps more in the order of service, which, by the way, you're welcome whenever you want to take it away with you so you can hang on to those announcements. There's also a flyer in the order of service for your attention. The announcements are, first of all, we still need someone to be the chairperson for the rummage sale, which is scheduled for Friday, May 14th, and Saturday, May 15th. This is a fundraiser for the church, an important one. If you're able to be the chair or perhaps co-chair, contact Esther or Kaz, who will be very happy to help you with taking on that responsibility. Are you missing a travel coffee mug? Try checking the office lost and found. There are lots of travel mugs in the box. I think one of mine might be in there, actually, now that I'm reading this. But be sure to dig down to the bottom because some of them have been there for a long time. Please note that the announcement about signing up to mow the church grounds, it's in the order of service, and there is a sign-up sheet in the in the social hall. That volunteer activity, which is a lot of fun, actually, saves the church a lot of money, too. Let's see next. Our annual church fundraiser that places the emphasis on fun is coming up on Saturday at 6 p.m. here at the church. It's Brewfest, the UU Homebrew Festival and Competition. You are all invited. Please come. There will be a potluck lunch featuring organic, locally produced, sustainably produced food in the social hall after the service. You are invited to join us. After lunch, please join with the earth-friendly activities such as primarily getting our church grounds and the garden for good ready for spring. Also, Ben Nelson of Oconomowoc brought his homegrown electric car. Meet Ben and see his car in the parking lot. There is an information table in the foyer with info on Waukesha County Recycling and Energy Conservation, including free low-flow shower heads and faucet heads, compliments of We Energies. Help yourself. This time I would like to invite all of you to greet those sitting around you. If you are visiting us today, if you are visiting us today, we particularly welcome you. Please sign the guest ledger on the visitors table in the foyer. There's a variety of information available on that table about our church and about Unitarian Universalism. Help yourself to any that interests you. I will be in the social hall after the service if you have any questions about our church, or if you've been visiting for a while and would like information about becoming a member, I'd be happy to speak with you as well. If you are visiting with your children, it is our custom for the children to remain with us until after the offertory, at which time they go to their religious education classes. Your child is welcome to join them or remain in the service. If you would like to go along to observe your child's class, please do so. The nursery is just out the door to my right, across the entryway, if there is need for childcare during the service. We always enjoy getting to know our guests. If any members have brought guests today, we would be pleased if you were to introduce them. If any guests have brought themselves and feel comfortable introducing themselves, this would be a good time to do so. Please just stand and mention your name or their name so that we can greet you.
My name is Ben. I brought my electric car here today. You all look at it later. And I got married here in the church 8 years ago.
Welcome. Welcome. Okay. Everyone is invited to gather in the social hall, but keep in mind, also keep in mind that the lunch is in the social hall after the service. and we hope that people are able to stay and enjoy that. Please put your cell phones on silence mode or turn them off. I hope you find this morning's service inspiring. I got myself all psyched for Earth Day by listening to the first Earth Opera CD on my way in today, so I'm ready to participate in the day and hope you will too. Today's speakers all participated in the Great Lakes Earth Institute discussion group called Reconnecting with Earth. I was a participant. We had a book to read and discussions. It was all very interesting. And this was just one of a number of Earth-friendly courses that are offered by the Institute, and we do plan to offer more of them here at LCUUC, so watch for announcements in the newsletter about upcoming courses. Yes, there you are, Greg, sorry.
So this is an old John Prine song, and a lot of you probably know it, so feel free to sing along in a chorus, because otherwise it gets long and boring. So this may be the first environmentalist song I ever heard after I'd waken up enough to notice. When I was a child, my family would travel down to Western Kentucky, where my parents were born. There's a backwards old town that's often remembered. So many times that my memories are worn. Daddy, won't you take me back to Muhlenberg County, down by the Green River, where paradise lay? Sorry, my son, but you're too late in asking. Mr. Peabody's coal train is hauling away. Sometimes we travel right down the Green River, abandoned old prison. Down by Adrian Hill, where the air smelled like snakes, we shoot with our pistols. Empty pop bottles is all we would kill. Daddy, won't you take me back to Muhlenberg County, down by the Green River, where paradise lay? Sorry, my son, but you're too late in asking. Peabody's gold train is hauling away. Tortured the timber and stripped all the land. They dug for their coal till the land was forsaken. Wrote it all down as progress of man. Daddy, won't you take me back to Muhlenberg County, down by the Green River where paradise lay? Sorry, my son, but you're too late in asking. Mr. Peabody's coal train is hauling away.
Good morning. Today's opening words come from, was delivered to the Saget UU Fellowship in Mount Vernon, Washington in November. It was written by David Cohen, and it's entitled The Ways of the Forest. Cutting wood, I leave a log to rest on the path to the woodpile. I walk past that log every week and watch it change. Mushrooms grow on it, then fungi and mold. Insects come and go, the log gets smaller, but ever so slowly. After 8 years, I kick at it, and it falls into smaller bits. A year or two later, and I can no longer tell where it lay. It is a life, It is my life. It is the way of nature and the world. It makes me feel a part of the whole cycle. I feel at peace. I believe in the forest. Everyone has a job in the forest. Everyone knows its job. The trees and the plants grow together in harmony. Everyone shares the sun, the soil, and the water. Everyone follows the rules and respects each other. Seasons come and go, and everyone knows what to do. Leaves fall, and the tiniest creatures recycle them. The animals who live in the forest know their part in the drama and cooperate. Some eat of the forest, while others are eaten. In the end, everyone dies, and it is recycled anew. Everything and everyone is needed and does its part. There is a true interdependence. It is nature's way evolved over time. Truly a miracle of balance. I believe in the ways of the forest.
Please remain seated for our chalice lighting. The words for the chalice lighting hymn are in the order of service. So the children would like to come forward, gather around for the story. We have a Dr. Seuss story today that Chris White and Diane Erickson will do for you.
Good morning. Everybody can hear me? Oh, I can hear myself. Good morning, children. We're going to read The Lorax by Dr. Seuss. Anybody know that story? You do? Oh, great. We're going to read it again. Okay. Deep in the grickle grass, some people say, if you look deep enough, you can still see today where the Lorax once stood, just as long as it could before somebody lifted the Lorax away. What was the Lorax and why was it there? And why was it lifted and taken somewhere? From the far end of town where the grickle grass grows, the old onceler still lives there. Ask him, he knows. Slup, down slups the whisper-ma-phone to your car, and the old onceler whispers are not very clear, since they have to come down through the snurgly hose, and he sounds as he had smallish bees up his nose. Now I'll tell you, he says, with his teeth sounding gray, how the lorax got lifted and taken away. It all started way back, such a long, long time back. Way back in the days when the grass was still green and the pond was still wet and the clouds were still clean and the song of the Swami swans rang out in space, one morning I came to this glorious place and I first saw the trees, the truffula trees, the bright colored tufts of the truffula trees. Hi. Mile after mile in the fresh morning breeze, in no time at all, I had built a small shop. Then I chopped down a truffula tree with a chop. And with great skillful skill and with great speedy speed, I took the soft tuft and I knitted a thneed. The instant that I'd finished, I heard a gazump. I looked. I saw some pop out of a stump of a tree I'd chopped down. It was sort of a man. Describe him? That's hard. I don't know if I can. He was shortish and oldish and brownish and mossy, and he spoke with a voice that was sharpish and bossy. "Mister," he said with a sawdusty sneeze, "I am the Lorax. I speak for the trees. I speak for the trees have no tongues, and I'm asking you, sir, at the top of my lungs." He was very upset as he shouted and puffed, "What's that thing you've made out of my truffle tuft?" "Look, Lorax," I said, "there's no cause for alarm. I chopped just one tree. I'm doing no harm. I'm being quite useful. This thing is a thneed. A thneed's a fine something that all people need. It's a shirt, it's a sock, it's a glove, it's a hat, but it has other uses, yes, far beyond that. You can use it for carpets, for pillows, for sheets, or curtains, or covers for bicycle seats." The Lorax said, "Sir, you are crazy with greed. There was no one on earth who would buy that fool thneed." "I repeat," cried the Lorax, "I speak for the trees. I'm busy," I told him. "Shut up, if you please." I rushed across the room and in no time at all built a radio phone. I put in a quick call. I called all my brothers and uncles and aunts and I said, "Listen here, here's a wonderful chance for the whole Wunsler family to get mighty rich. Get over here fast. Take the road to the North Niche. Turn left at Weehawken. Sharp turn at South Stitch." And in no time at all, the factory I built, the whole Wunsler family was working full tilt. We're all busy knitting thneeds, just as busy as bees, to the sound of the chopping of the truffle trees. Then, oh baby, oh, how my business did grow. Now chopping one tree at a time was too slow, so I quickly invented my super axe hacker, which hacked off four truffle trees in one smacker. We were making thneeds four times as fast as before, and that Lorax, he didn't show up anymore. But the next week he knocked on my new office door. He snapped, "I am the Lorax who speaks for the trees, which you seem to be chopping as fast as you please, but I'm also in charge of the brown barbaloots who played in the shade in their barbaloot suits and happily lived eating truffalo fruits. Now, thanks to your hacking my trees to the ground, there's not enough truffle of fruit to go round, and my poor barbaloots are all getting the crummies because they have gas and no food in their tummies. They loved living here, but I can't let them stay. They'll have to find food, and I hope that they may. Good luck, boys," he cried, and he sent them away. I, the Wunsler, felt sad as I watched them go, but business is business, and business must grow, regardless of crummies in tummies, you know. And then again he came back. I was fixing some pipes when that old nuisance Lorax came back with more gripes. "I am the Lorax," he coughed and he whiffed. He sneezed and he snuffled. He snarled, he sniffed. "Wunsler," he cried with a cruffulous croak, "Wunsler, you're making a smogulous smoke. My poor Swami swans, why, they can't sing a note. No one can sing who has smog in their throat." "And so," said the Lorax, "please pardon my cough. They cannot live here, so I'm sending them off. Where will they go? I don't hopefully know. They may have to fly for a month or a year to escape from the smog you've smogged up around here. You're glumping the pond where the humming fish hummed. No more can they hum, for their gills are all gummed. So I'm sending them off. Oh, their fortune is dreary. They'll walk on their fins and get woefully weary in search of some water that isn't so smeary." And then I got mad. I got terribly mad. I yelled at the Larks, "Now listen here, Dad. All you do is yap, yap and say bad, 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 bad. Well, I have my rights, sir, and I'm telling you, I intend to go on doing just like what I do. And for your information, you Lorax, I'm figuring on biggering and biggering and biggering and biggering, turning more truffle trees into thneeds, which everyone needs." At that very moment, we heard a loud whack. From outside the fields came a sickening smack of an axe on a tree. Then we heard the tree fall, the very last truffle tree of them all. no more trees, no more needs, no more work to be done. So in no time, my uncles and aunts, everyone, all waved me goodbye. They jumped into my cars and drove away under smoke-smothered stars. Well, I guess we'll see. That's right. That's what it says. Huh, good reading. Now, all that was left neath the bad-smelling sky was my big empty factory, the Lorax and I. The Lorax said nothing, just gave me a glance, just gave me a very sad backward glance as he lifted himself by the seat of his pants, and I'll never forget the grim look on his face when he heisted himself and took leave of this place through a hole in the smog without leaving a trace. And all that the Lorax left here in this mess was a small pile of rocks with one word, unless. Whatever that meant, well, I just couldn't guess. That was long, long ago, but each day since that day, I sat here and worried away. Through the years, while my buildings had fallen apart, I've worried about it with all of my heart. But now, said the Onceler, now that you're here, the word of the Lorax seems perfectly clear. Unless someone like you cares a whole awful lot, nothing is going to get better. It's not. So, catch, called the Onceler. He let something fall. It's a truffle seed. It's the last one of all. You're in charge of the last of the truffle seeds, and the truffle trees are what everyone needs. Plant a new truffle. Treat it with care. Give it clean water and feed it fresh air. Grow a forest. Protect it from axes that hack. Then the Lorax and all of his friends may come back. So we have some seeds for you. So here, come and get a pack. Come and get a pack. They're kind of all the same. Yeah, just grab one. Okay? Okay, grab a pack. Grab a pack. Grab a pack. Grab a pack. Did you get a pack? Here, Bjorn. Grab a pack. Grab a pack. Grab a pack. Did you get seeds?
Is that a print?
Yes. Oh, grab a pack.
Hi, Miles. Hi. Oh. I'm Ryan, but Jade, okay.
Hi. Okay. Do you want to grab that?
The offering is a sacrament of the Free Church. It will now be given and received in grateful appreciation of our shared hopes and values. Now, before we have the offering, I'd like to point out that in your order of service, we have a couple of brochures. One is a brochure from the Unitarian Universalist Ministry for Earth, and the other is a little handout from Waukesha County Recycling. There'll be a special collection today to support the mission of UU Ministry for Earth. So as it says in your order of service, if you wish to donate to the UU Ministry of Earth, write out your check to LCUUC and put UUMFE on the envelope or in the check memo line. In any event, I encourage you to take these brochures home with you, look them over, and if you support the goals of the UU Ministry for Earth, I encourage you to join them. Now is the time in our service where you're invited to share your joys and concerns with the congregation here today. I will light our main candle in honor of Earth Day. This is the 40th anniversary of Earth Day, which was started by our very own Senator Gaylord Nelson. So let us think of the implications of all that's happened with efforts towards appreciation and improvement of our environment in these last 40 years. So now, if you have a joy or a concern, please raise your hand and the host will bring the microphone for you.
Hi, my name is Stacy, and I'd like a candle of concern lit for my uncle and my cousin. They were both recently diagnosed with lung cancer.
A candle of joy for Anna Friss, whose birthday is on Earth Day the 22nd.
I'm Amy. Excuse me. When I started coming here with my son about 3 years ago, he was still nursing and sitting on my lap and wouldn't leave my side. And now he runs to the front pew by himself and sits up there with his hymnal. So please light a candle of joy for the interesting journey that he has taken us on. Thank you.
Light a candle of joy. Abby's gotten a couple of really nice accolades for her violin playing over the last few weeks, and she's been working really hard, so we're real proud of her.
I'm Tom, and yesterday was our monthly Habitat for Humanity work day, and it must be because the cap I'm wearing says Habitat on it, but people mistakenly assume that I'm in charge of anything at all. But I had the privilege of being thanked again by the homeowner, and so I'm going to pass on that to you. The work project was at 18th and Greenfield.
Again. A candle of joy for my daughter, who will be turning 12, also on Earth Day, because she shares a birthday with Anna.
Terry, if you could please light a candle for the Loida family. One of my students' father had a heart attack and passed away suddenly. So the whole family is obviously still stunned.
I'm Yvonne. Would you light a candle? It can just be one candle. Thanks for showing the movie and arranging and making the popcorn and all of that for the movie Food, Inc. last night. It was really eye-opening, and it's really easy to just close your eyes until someone pokes you and says, watch this movie.
If you could just light a candle for my father. He suffered from a mild heart attack over the weekend and has a lot of tests that are going on right now, so that'd be great.
I have a candle of joy for Linda Francebrow, who generously donated a microwave oven for our kitchen to replace the one that no longer works.
I'm Colleen, and a candle for concern. Friends of mine, the Benzes, have a granddaughter 2 years old in Fredert, and his mother, who's going under some health issues. Thank you.
And a last candle for the joys and concerns which we keep in our hearts. will share a meditation with us.
Our morning meditation is a quote from Aldo Leopold from his Sand Country Almanac, and I have to just mention that when I was doing a little research on the quote, there'll be a documentary film coming out later this year. It'll probably be on public television entitled Green Fire. It's a story of Aldo Leopold's life. We were eating lunch on a high rim rock at the foot of which a turbulent river elbowed its way. We saw what we thought was a doe fording the torrent, her breast awash in the white water. When she climbed the bank toward us and shook out her tail, we realized our error. It was a wolf. A half dozen others, evidently grown pups, sprang from the willows and all joined in a welcoming melee, wagging tails and playful maulings. What was literally a pile of wolves riled and tumbled in the center of an open flat at the foot of our rim rock. In those days, we had never passed up a chance to kill a wolf. In a second, we were pumping lead into the pack, but with more excitement than accuracy. How to aim a steep downhill shot is always confusing. When our rifles were empty, the old wolf was down, and a pup was dragging a leg into an impassable rock slide. We reached the old wolf in time to watch a fierce green fire dying in her eyes. I realized then, and have known ever since, that there was something new to me in those eyes, something known only to her and the mountain. I was young then and full of trigger itch. I thought that because fewer wolves meant more deer, that no wolves would mean a hunter's paradise. But after seeing the green fire die, I sensed that neither the wolf nor the mountain agreed with such a view.
Please remain seated for our centering hymn number 309, Earth is Our Homeland.
These readings and thoughts are from the members of the Reconnecting with Earth discussion group. And the first session theme was wild nature. And I chose to read an abridged excerpt from The Judgment of the Birds by Lauren Isley. And this is about a crow who lives near the author's home. On the particular morning when this episode occurred, the whole countryside was buried in the thickest fog in years. A pedestrian could hardly see his outstretched hand before him. I was groping across a field towards the railroad station, following a dimly outlined path. Suddenly, out of the fog, and so closely that I flinched, there flashed a pair of immense black wings and a huge beak. The whole bird rushed over my head with a frantic, cawing outcry of such hideous terror as I have never heard in a crow's voice before. All afternoon, that great awkward cry rang in my head. Merely being lost in the fog seems scarcely to account for this crow's terror. I even looked once in the mirror to see what the crow might have seen that revolted him so. Finally, as I worked my way homeward along the path, the solution came to me. It should have been clear before. The borders of our worlds had shifted in that fog. The crow had been lost, all right, but it was more than that. He had thought he was high up, and when he encountered me, looming gigantically through the fog, he had perceived a ghastly and unnatural sight, desecrating the very heart of the Crow Kingdom, a harbinger of the most profound evil a Crow mind could conceive of, air-walking men. He caws now when he sees me leaving, and in that note I hear the uncertainty of a mind that has come to know that things are not always what they seem. He and I share a viewpoint in common. Our worlds have interpenetrated, and we both have faith in the miraculous.
The section of the book Reconnecting to Earth that I will be drawing from is titled Nature and Spirit. There's an awful lot in this section that I love to read to you, but I've only got a few minutes, so I'm going to choose just snippets from several of the articles. And I would like to start with a quote that starts this section out. It's from Hildegard de Bingen, an 11th century mystic. "We shall awaken from our dullness and rise vigorously toward justice. If we fall in love with creation deeper and deeper, we will respond to its endangerment with passion." The first snippet I'm going to read comes from an article by a medical doctor, and the background to this is he was a chief of staff at a hospital, an evangelical Christian, and he looked around at the life that he had built, a very wealthy neighborhood, nice family, etc., and he decided that it failed to properly honor God. That's a quote from him. So he and his family downsized. He wrote a book titled Serve God, Save the Planet, and he started going around the country speaking. And this is a question and answer session, and the question being posed to him is, "Do you have any advice for environmentalists on how to speak to religious people, evangelicals in particular?" And his answer is this: "When I go and talk at a conservative church, they may go from saying that there's no global warming to deciding as a church to switch their power to green power or change light bulbs to CFLs, that sort of thing. It literally can happen in one session. What people say is, well, nobody ever told us about this. Why didn't somebody tell us about this? Environmentalists would say, well, they're nuts. They're not just not paying any attention. It's overwhelming. But these two different groups get their news and their information from two entirely different sides of the spectrum. The folks at 60 Minutes have a different crowd than the folks at the Salem Radio Network. And Salem Radio Network has a way bigger crowd. They don't even know each other exists. It's a chasm." And I'm reading that only because it struck me, because as I read it, I thought, well, gosh, I don't know what Salem Radio Network is. And I Googled it, and I learned that it's a very, it's a Christian radio station that does, it's countrywide. It's got a lot going on. So that's just something that caught my eye. The second one I'm going to read a paragraph from. It's titled First Do No Harm. It's by a woman who's a Buddhist, and she's talking about how to use Buddhist principles in environmental causes. And she's talking about using the Four Noble Truths of Buddhism. The first noble truth begins with the suffering that arises from the inevitability of change and loss. Most of the time, we would rather not think about the suffering caused by our actions. Yet from a Buddhist perspective, this is the best place to start, for it is grounded in reality, not idealized projection. Mindful awareness is all about direct experience of the actual state of things. The authenticity of such perceptions is freeing and motivating at the same time. Practices that quiet and focus the mind can provide a stable mental base from which to observe the whole catastrophe of human impact. To be with environmental suffering means being willing to be with the suffering produced by your own cultural conditioning toward other than human beings. Those of us in the West have been raised to see forests and rivers as potential resources. Human-centered views are one of the greatest deterrents to being fully present with other living beings. If you see an environment as primarily for human use, whether for food, shelter, recreation, or spiritual development, you may not see how others suffer under the thumb of human dominance. I could read more of this, but I don't have time, so I'm going to move on to the next article. By the way, if anyone is interested in any of these, just let me know. You're welcome to borrow my book and read more. The third and final article that I'm going to read from is called Sharing One's Skin, and is written by a woman who is a member of the Okanagan Native American tribe. They live in British Columbia. It's a beautiful part of the country with the Cascade Mountains on one side and other mountains on the other side. The Columbia River runs through it. And she's talking a lot about her culture and how spirituality and being with the land is an integral part. And I'm picking up in the middle of this and reading just a few paragraphs. This section is called The Language of the Land. The third difference between the Okanagan perception of the self and that of the dominant culture has to do with the us that is place, the capacity to know we are everything that surrounds us, to experience our humanness in relation to all else, and in consequence, to know how we affect the world around us. The Okanagan word for our place on the land and our language is the same. We think of our language as the language of the land. We also refer to the land and to our bodies with the same root syllable. This means that the flesh that is our body is pieces of the land, come to us through the things that the land is, the soil, the water, the air, and all the other life forms contributed parts to be our flesh. We are our land, our place. Not to know and to celebrate this is to be without language and without land. It is to be displaced. The Okanagan teach that anything displaced from all that it requires to survive in health will eventually perish. Unless place can be relearned, all other life forms will face displacement and then ruin. As Okanagan, our most essential responsibility is to bond our whole individual and communal selves to the land. Many of our ceremonies have been constructed for this. We join with the larger self and with the land and rejoice in all that we are. We are this one part of the earth. Without this self and this bond, we are not human. And I will end with a paragraph further on in her article. In a healthy, whole community, the people interact with each other in shared emotional response. They move together emotionally to respond to crisis or celebration. They commune in the everyday act of living. Being a part of such a communing is to be fully alive, fully human. To be without community in this way is to be alive only in the flesh, to be alone, to be lost, to be inhuman. It is then possible to violate and destroy others and their property without remorse.
I chose this excerpt from the universe story because it spoke to me. Viewed from the moon, the most astonishing thing about the earth is that it is alive. Beneath the moist, gleaming membrane of bright blue sky, it has the self-contained look of a live creature full of information, marvelously skilled in handling the sun. Earth is not a planet with life on it. Rather, it is a living planet. The physical structure of the planet, its core, mantle, and mountain ranges, acts as the skeleton or frame of its existence. The soil that covers its grasslands and forests is like a mammoth digestive system. In it, all things are broken down, absorbed, and recycled into new growth. The oceans, waterways, and rain function as a circulatory system that moves life-giving blood, purifying and revitalizing the body. The bacteria, algae, plants, and trees provide the planet's lungs, constantly regenerating the entire atmosphere. The animal kingdom provides the functions of a nervous system, a finely tuned and diversified series of organisms sensitized to environmental change. Each species is a unique expression of planetary consciousness with its own unique gifts to the body, period. Humanity allows the planet to exercise self-conscious awareness or reflexive thought. That is, the human enables Earth to reflect on itself and on the divine mystery out of which it has come and in which it exists. We are a means by which nature can appreciate its own beauty and feel its own splendor or destroy itself. This shift from seeing ourselves as separate beings placed on Earth, the world was made for us, to seeing ourselves as a self-reflexive expression of Earth, we were made for the world, is a major shift in our understanding of who and what we are. It is a shift at the deepest possible level, our identity or sense of self. Indeed, this shift to seeing ourselves a part of a living planet, which is our larger self, is essential to our survival because it can serve in lieu of morality. Moralizing is ineffective. Sermons don't hinder us from pursuing our self-interest. Therefore, we need to be a little more enlightened about what our self-interest is. It would not occur to me, for example, to exhort you to refrain from cutting off your leg. That wouldn't occur to me or to you because your leg is part of you. Well, so are the trees in the Amazon basin. They are our external lungs. We are just beginning to wake up to that. We are gradually discovering that we are our world.
The chapter that I have taken an excerpt from was called Eco-Psychology. And the author of this definition, if you will, of eco-psychology was John Seed. In spite of the modern delusion of alienation, the separation from the living Earth, we humans are not aliens. We belong here. The human psyche, too, is earthborn, the result of 4,000 million years of continuous evolution. The complex dynamic biology from which the psyche emerged is necessarily remains the matrix, the grounding for any sane psychology. I take eco-psychology to mean psychology in service to the earth. We have all heard about the massive assault on our life support systems, yet it has not changed our behavior except in rather trivial ways. How will we change our thinking and our behavior to bring our technologies and lifestyles into harmony with the biological constraints of earthly existence? What is needed? Not more horrifying statistics, surely. Everybody already knows we feel helpless and disempowered as the technologic juggernaut rolls on. Scientists have warned that we may be the last generation of humanity to have a chance to avert biological collapse and irreparable damage to the systems that support complex life on Earth. Paul Ehrlich thinks that we are sawing off the branch that we're sitting on. James Lovestock says it's as if the brain were to decide that it was the most important organ in the body and started to mine the liver. Sounds to me like some kind of a psychological problem. Yet psychology appears to be too busy to address such things. What are the matters of overriding urgency preoccupying psychology? Where is everybody? Playing as business as usual? Fiddling while Rome burns? Shuffling chairs on the Titanic?
The final session of this course was titled Bringing It Down to Earth. And, well, like the Voluntary Simplicity course that we had last year, many of these readings were very beautiful and inspiring and thought-provoking, but the highlight for me was the interaction in the group, getting to know some of the church members better and sharing and learning from them. The course, many of the readings had a philosophical approach to understanding our relationship to Earth, and this final chapter tried to move from theory to practice. Some of the readings were The Learning Curve by David Orr, that all education is environmental education. Starhawk had a beautiful one on developing bonds with place and argues that a more ecocentric culture begins with each of us finding one place and getting to know it intimately. And after seeing the movie last night, reread the Wendell Berry, The Pleasures of Eating, where he discussed that for most people living in industrial societies, eating has become divorced from its agricultural roots. Yet the act of eating offers the greatest possible possibility for connecting more deeply with the world around us. And the chapter ends, and this kind of fits in with the opening words. It just kind of spoke to me and made me think of the seventh principle of UU, the respect for the interdependent web of all existence, of which we are a part. And it's the Declaration of Interdependence. It was written by members of the David Suzuki Foundation and delivered to the United Nations Earth Summit in Rio de Janeiro in 1992, and seems even more important or apropos today. This we know, we are the earth through the plants and animals that nourish us. We are the rains and the oceans that flow through our veins. We are the breath of the forest, of the land, and the plants of the sea. We are human animals related to all other life as descendants of the firstborn cell. We share with these kin a common history written in our genes. We share a common presence filled with uncertainty. And we share a common future as yet untold. We humans are but one of 30 million species weaving a thin layer of life enveloping the world. The stability of communities of living things depends upon this diversity. Linked in that web, we are interconnected, using cleansing, sharing, and replenishing the fundamental elements of life. Our home, planet Earth, is finite. All life shares its resources and the energy from the sun, and therefore has limits to growth. For the first time, we have touched those limits. When we compromise air, the water, the soil, the variety of life, we steal from the endless future to serve the fleeting present. This we believe. Humans have become so numerous that our tools so powerful that we have driven fellow creatures to extinction, dammed the great rivers, tore down ancient forests, poisoned the earth, rain and wind, and ripped holes in the sky. Our science has brought pain as well as joy. Our comfort is paid for by the suffering of millions. We are learning from our mistakes. We are mourning our vanished kin. And now we build a new politics of hope. We respect and uphold the absolute need for clean air, water, and soil. We see that economic activities that benefit the few while shirking the inheritance of many are wrong. And since environmental degradation erodes biological capital forever, full ecological and social cost must enter all equations of development. So where knowledge is limited, we will remember all those who will walk after us and err on the side of caution. This we resolve. All this that we know and believe must now become the foundation of the way we live. At this turning point in our relationship with Earth, We work for an evolution from dominance to partnership, from fragmentation to connection, from insecurity to interdependence.
We now have an opportunity to share any thoughts on today's program or on the
with our environment, and just want to mention one thing that is of interest to me now. I started a hobby of beekeeping, and it'll be real interesting to just to see how the bees collect their nectar and grow the colony and stuff, and I just think it's going to be kind of a fun hobby. There are some pitfalls, I guess, with colony collapse syndrome and some other things like that, but just thought I'd share that.
I'm Diane. I was privileged to see the meteor streak across the western sky the other night. I just looked up from my chair, and there it was, and I saw the entire trajectory. And, of course, I had no idea how large it was. So I went to the door because I thought, if this is the one that's going to take out the Earth, I want to go real fast. But it really did make me realize that we are just living on the edge, and so we should take care of our Earth and enjoy it, but honor it for as long as we live.
So when hearing about your beekeeping, I've taken up the hobby slightly of foraging for wild foods. And so yesterday I went out and picked some different things, some greens, but I was looking online trying to figure out what something was, and I discovered that burdock is completely edible, depending on how old it is and whatever. And burdock, all through my whole childhood and my whole, anytime I live at my mom's house, has been like the bane of my existence. It's the worst plant, and I just hate it. And so I discovered that people find this to be a delicacy. You can order the seeds and plant it in your garden, and it was brought here by Europeans as a crop. It's not a native plant. And so now this is the first time I've ever been excited about burdock. So now I'm waiting until the second year plants shoot up so I can go out and harvest some burdock and try it. But it was such a switch in my perspective. It was just, I had this yesterday, this moment of wishing that the burdock had gotten bigger. And I was like, what is wrong? You know? But it was just an interesting switch in perspective.
I noticed that somebody brought a dish today for our lunch made from garlic mustard, another plant we all love to hate. That'll be interesting.
Hi, my name is Tom, and I'm discouraged. I'm hoping you can encourage me. But the thought of changing our way of life to leave a lighter footprint, it just seems overwhelming to me. I mean, I know I've been a bicycle commuter my whole life, and I mean to and from work, I don't mean recreation. And every day I have the thought of how I'm using the transportation system in a way it was not intended, at my own risk. And it just seems like in order to do something off the beaten track that is more than just symbolic is really hard. I don't know what your thoughts are on that.
Well, the Titanic was a big ship, and it was hard to turn around. I hope we turn it around before we hit the iceberg. Yeah, figuratively, of course.
I appreciate it. My name is Mike. I very much appreciated the service this morning and the work that was put into it. The Lauren Isley story was really fascinating with that crow imagining a human up in in the air with it, and on the idea of perception isn't exactly what you may think. A number of years ago, there was a 747 that was flying along in the out over the ocean, and there was a small dark cloud, and that's normally no problem with a with an aircraft of that magnitude or any other aircraft flying through a small cloud. And as it flew through it, all four engines flamed out because it was a volcanic cloud. And it was a small cloud. It was the first experience, I think, that anybody'd had with that. They were able to relight a couple of the engines, and after a harrowing flight, did survive that. But it just goes to show how some of the perceptions we have are just not what they seem.
Hi, I'm Barb, and I can really relate to Tom's comment. My own personal answer is that you just dig in somewhere. You know, you just have to pick those things, and you know, I mean, I don't really know about bike commuting. I ride recreationally, so I don't ride the same roads that you do, Tom. But I think the bike lanes have improved somewhat. Right, I know, and that's really hard. But I think we just, you know, we got to pick a spot. It's every step.
Well, another example of the hill that we have to climb here is there's a in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel today on their editorial page. They had one editorial by somebody from the Heartland Institute or something like that. It made the claim that a clean environment is a luxury that we can only afford if our corporations are profitable enough. Read it yourself. I'm not kidding.
I'm Robin, and I think one thing that is the dinosaur in the corner is that the money is accumulated to the smallest and most greedy people. And I was reminded of a saying that if Bill Gates should happen to wander into a soup kitchen where there were 50 people, the average net worth would be $1 billion. And so I think we have to pay attention to politics and do what we can to get the right people in office so that because they right now they are just building up power, and it's that's all we can do is look at it in dismay. But if we all think of who we can support and support them, we still may have a chance.
Could we continue our discussions? Well, let's have a couple. We'll have a couple more. Two more.
I'll be quick. This is Mark. Just a reminder of anyone who doesn't know about next Saturday, Greener Conwalk Earth Day Resource Fair. Ben will be back there with his electric cars, and there'll be lots of different things to learn about for Earth Day on next Saturday, Greenwalk at the Conwalk High School, 11 to 3, free admission.
And I'm Tyrion, along the lines of inspiration, when you work with young people, and I just have the privilege of, you know, teaching high school and sharing with them things like these documentaries, and when you think of maybe having to wait a generation, it's so hard, of course, convincing our generation to make huge changes when we're in a particular comfort level. But you watch them and see them make changes. And to speak to just one effect, Duffy Tillman, one of my students, and I'm not taking complete responsibility for this, but I've always said to them, you know, I know that there are solar stoves out there, and why can't someone get one into these refugee camps so we don't have all this exhaust and people risking their lives of rape, et cetera. He won the Big Idea Award in London
when he was out east at school and actually invented a solar oven that is made in for a dollar and sold for two and collapsible, and it frees the women all day from having to cook and is saving thousands of lives from the exhaust in camps. And I guess it's just the ripple effect of just, you know, one thought to some of these children, and they start thinking right. And they're so techno, and they start e-petitioning, and they start affecting change. So it does happen.
Please rise as you're willing and able for hymn number 21, For the Beauty of the Earth. Deep peace of the running wave to you. Deep peace of the flowering air to you. Deep peace of the quiet earth to you. Deep peace of the shining stars to you. Deep peace of the infinite peace to you. Again, you're welcome to join us for our organic, locally produced, sustainable lunch. And don't forget to stop by the giveaway table in the front foyer and help yourselves. Go in peace.